Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm the senior editor at American Theater.
And I'm Deep Tran, the associate editor at American Theater.
And I'm Susie Evans, and I'm the managing editor.
That's my first time introducing myself
exactly,
with that title.
Exactly, I was going to say. Yeah. Associate editor, welcome to the... welcome to being our associate.
I know, mid-level field. It's like I'm no one's assistant anymore. This is very exciting.
Congratulations, Deep, on your new title. Richly deserved. We have a great show today. We talked to Diane Rodriguez, who is the chairman of the TCG board. And the TCG had just had a big flurry of fall activity with a big board meeting, a fall forum, which you can read about online, as well as a gala. So a bunch of TCG's board was in town. And Diane hails from Los Angeles, so she tells us a little bit about Los Angeles, about what TCG's up to, and as well as the recent gathering in Los Angeles, Encuentro 2014, a month-long festival of Latino theater. So that's an interesting interview. Diane goes back a long way with American Theater and with...
And also with
me in particular. I knew her from L.A.
Doesn't she work at Center Theater Group?
And she works at the Center Theater Group. It's a little confusing. She works
at AD.
CTG and TCG. Don't mix them up. But
I go to a church at place at TGC.
TGC?
Yeah. TGC, CTG, TCG.
It's a lot of acronyms. We want to start off the show. So that interview will be in a few minutes. Just talking about our December issue, which is already making its way into people's mailboxes. And we'll be
slowly trickling
out online. We're not sure when you listen to this what will be available online, but some of these stories will be. Our cover story this month, if I can just plunge in, is on sort of a legendary American theater company. I mean, it really deserves a place alongside the great ensembles like Wooster Group and other ones like that. The Actors Gang from Los Angeles, which was founded by Tim Robbins in the late 70s, early 80s. Early 80s, actually, after the Olympic Arts Festival exposed Los Angeles to some of the great international theater companies, including specifically the Théâtre du Soleil from Paris and Georges Bigot. I think I pronounced that correctly. Looks like Georges Bigot, if you spell it right. But Georges Bigot. And his Commedia-based style became the Actors Gang's. They adapted it in their own sort of punk rock way. In any case, my history with the gang, I'll make this fairly brief. There's a great interview that Joe Eastburn does with Tim Robbins, who's still going strong with the gang for many years. But it's funny, my exposure to the gang was in the late 90s when Tim was on a break and living in New York and on a break from really active gang activity. And he was...
I love that sentence.
Gang activity, yes. Yes,
on a break from gang activity.
There's a lot of...
theater gangs, like the most exactly. deadly of gangs.
They are. There's a lot of great jokes you make, gang-related. I think there's been headlines like that for the Actors Gang. But in any case, he was helping to fund the gang, but he wasn't actively involved. And the work I saw at their space in Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard was mostly by people other than him. Some of his associates were still involved, but directors like Tracy Young and performers like Chris Wells were doing amazing, defining work of my theater-going career and collaborating with Cornerstone, doing an amazing production of... Bill Rausch and Tracy Young did a production of Medea, Macbeth, and Cinderella, the Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella, all as one play, which was an amazing thing. And I remember... I'll just tell you briefly, I interviewed Tim when he was coming back to the company and bringing Georges Bigot for workshops. I interviewed him on September 10th, 2011, in the theater. We were talking about the shows, and I mentioned Medea, Macbeth, Cinderella, and we were in a theater. And I think that's the only time anyone has ever took that superstition seriously. And we went downstairs, and he made me turn. He was asking people, what do you do to sort of break the curse of saying Macbeth in a theater? And I had to spin around outside, and someone gave me some salt to throw over my shoulder. And
Tim Robbins made you do this?
Yeah. He did it sort of genially and like not too forcedly, but he made it clear that we need to purge this curse. Totally unrelatedly, the next day, of course, was September 11th. He was actually, and his family was here. I heard a story that he had got a car, and he was driving across the country because he couldn't fly. So he drove across the country to get home to his family on September 11th. But that's some of the Actors Gang lore you won't read in this issue. It's actually a really interesting story about the company he's continued to lead in Culver City. They moved to Culver City, and they're really engaged with the community there. And they recently have been touring shows in the past, actually the past decade or so. He's been creating shows at the Gang, like 1984 and Embedded, and this new production of Midsummer Night's Dream, which he's toured to the Spoleto Festival and as well recently to China. So it's interesting and I think inspiring Q&A with a theater original. Worth a read.
When I was reading it, I loved all the, there's also the touring aspect and the global mm-hmm. aspect, but I also love the social justice aspect of it too, which is the theme of our January issue.
Yes, it is.
Free preview right there. And I loved the part where he was talking about they're taking their shows to prisons and like teaching these guys how to write and how to perform. And then he said the people that they've worked with, they now have a 0% like
recidivism rate. Yeah.
I cannot pronounce that word. I'm sorry.
It's a weird word. Yeah.
It's so interesting considering that I can't say that word, but
recidivism.
It's such a huge problem right now when it comes to our jail system.
Sure.
And it's topics which are addressed in shows like Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's sort of an anecdotal figure, and I think that the goals of a program, a wider program, would not be necessarily a zero recidivism rate, but it definitely reduces. Has been shown to reduce their engagement with creating theater. The gang that I knew was doing great work. They weren't necessarily doing the kind of outreach and social justice work that I know Tim has always been committed to. So I salute them for that. It's a great part of what they're doing.
Yeah, when did they start doing the global touring and the social justice
outreach? The global touring has been, from what I gather, the gang did a few of, if I look back into the history, they toured a few times and brought shows to New York to sort of say, here, we're here, like Steppenwolf coming to New York, like here, we're this out-of-town company you've heard about. And it got mixed response from what I remember. Then after Embedded was a show Tim created after the Iraq War and brought that to New York and then toured that. I mean, part of the thinking was that, you know, L.A. works under a pretty non-remunerative plan for actors, the 99-seat plan, and you don't make a lot of money doing theater there, even under the best conditions. And touring works on an actual contract. So it's actually been creating paid work for a lot of these Actors Gang performers to take their shows around not just the country but the world. The college circuit is one place I think Embedded went. And I think in 1984 has been to, I think Jim saw it in Brazil a couple years ago at the festival there. So I think touring is a way not just to expose the work but also give work to the members of the theater. So, yeah, I think it's been an emphasis since Tim got back, in short.
How does he balance it with his, you know, screen schedule?
Well, I think he's based out in L.A. now, so that helps. Because when the time he wasn't as involved, he was based here in New York. But he's much more involved now. And I don't know if he's hands-on all the time. He does have a co-artistic director, Cynthia Edinger, who's one of the original members. I think it's something he talks about. It's something that is really fulfills what he's always dreamed of doing, which is making theater and making a difference. And I think even your biggest Hollywood stars, at some point, they hit a plateau of what they feel like they can do in that field. You know, he's done it all. He's directed films, acted. He has a TV show, I think, now HBO something. I don't know. We're out of touch with that here, aren't we?
What is this, television or
theater? Yeah, exactly.
Or television about theater. Last night I was at Marie's Crisis, which is this bar in the West Village.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Where you sing show tunes. And we sang Let Me Be Your Star, and I was thinking, oh my God, this is like a very, I don't know if it's meta, but it's like a melding of worlds. It was a nice moment.
Well, Alan Menken's scoring that like miniseries that's coming out in January. I forget what it's going to be called. Some musical 4-episode show. Written by Alan Menken.
I'd watch that.
Sounds good.
So wait, it took me a second. Let me be your stars from that.
Smash.
But it's written by Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman.
Also known as trash to me. No, just kidding.
Yeah, I agree.
So we should talk about other things in the issue that we're really, really proud and happy to be publishing Taylor Mack's script here, H-I-R, which is a gender-neutral pronoun, would just like him and her in one, right? And Susie, you you sat with him and Lisa as they interviewed each other.
Yeah, I one of the favorite parts of my job here at American Theater is getting to do the play script interview when we publish plays, which is when we have the playwright sit down with an artistic luminary, whether it be a collaborator or a friend or someone they've worked with, and they kind of talk about the play. And this issue, we have a really great Q&A with Taylor Mack and Lisa Krohn, who acted together in Good Person of Szechuan at the Public Theater, and they've known each other from
and
their
the Foundry,
downtown.
Yeah.
And where?
Oh, and it was at the Foundry first, and then at the Public.
The Foundry's. Yeah, it wasn't that La Mama, too? The Foundry did it at La Mama,
yeah.
And then it was at the Public. And they've known each other from their downtown theater work, Lisa and Taylor, both performers and playwrights of all stripes. And so they sat down and had a very, very fascinating conversation about, you know, gender and representation on stage and downtown theater work versus, you know, regional Lort style theater work, where maybe Lort's the wrong word, but theater work where, you know, you are getting paid within an institution versus making it yourself. And it was really fascinating. And yeah, it's there'll be an extended version of the interview hopefully online, but in the magazine, I think, trying to pull it up here.
We're still not publishing the scripts online, but the interviews with the playwrights for our play scripts are always online.
The interviews are online, and they're really illuminating. I mean, sometimes you will have need to read the play, but I think in this case, it's still an interesting conversation about theater and gender and institutions. And
can we? It's going to be. It played initially at.
It played at the Magic Theater in San Francisco, and we're announcing in this issue. So I believe we can announce on this podcast that it's going to be at Playwrights Horizons in 2015.
That's what I wanted to know. Can we announce that Playwrights Horizons?
It's in the footnotes of the play, and Taylor said it in the interview, and so.
Yeah, and wasn't this the one that we mentioned in the previous podcast?
Yes, we did.
He's been trying to get there. Uh-huh. He's been trying to get there for years, and he had to write like a straight. Well, not
a conventional play.
Well, I think what I found so interesting about this interview was, you know, Taylor is known as a performer and for a lot of his drag performance and his performance art. The Lily's Revenge is one of his biggest, you know, successes as a performance artist and writer. But he's been trying for years to get into what, quote unquote, institutional theater, somewhere where, you know, there'll be a publicity team and a marketing team and et cetera, et cetera. And so he wrote this kitchen sink drama that he was initially intending to write as kind of a commentary on the kitchen sink drama, how it's not supposed to, you know, how it doesn't work and how it's an antiquated form. But he told Lisa in the interview that he ended up falling in love with the form and found that it worked and really served the form in his writing. And while it's not that he wrote a kitchen sink drama play to get into an institutional theater, that was not the goal. It's ironic that this is the play that finally got him into an institutional theater. He wrote the play because he wanted to write the play, but right. The irony is that this is the one that got him in.
Right.
And so it's interesting. I mean, I think it's going to be a different side of Taylor Mack than people have seen while still being true to, you know, his voice as a playwright. He's not in the play. There's not a part for him. He often performs in his works.
And yet he's in every bit of the play.
And yet he's in every word. But it's part of his Dionysia Festival, which are four plays that he's planning to have performed in repertory. There's going to be an all-ages play. There's the kitchen sink drama here, which is published. There's a dance theater play called The Bourgeois Oligarch, which is going to be commissioned by ART and the Boston Ballet. And then there's going to be a site-specific musical as well. And so four pieces in the festival, all different forms. And so the discussion about content and form is also really interesting in the interview. They talk a lot about Ruth Margraf's idea that you can't mess with content and form at the same time, and how maybe you can do it for the right audiences, maybe the downtown audience and audiences that expect that. But when you're working within an institutional theater and subscription audiences, sometimes you have to give the audience what they expect so that they're not uncomfortable. So you want to challenge them with the content rather than with the form. Really, really interesting stuff. So it's like a masterclass in theater.
Definitely worth a read.
I'm excited for his show that's going to be at the New Victory. I forget
what. Oh yes, I don't know what it's called, but
I forget what it's called. But it's going to involve playing in the mud,
yeah,
and yeah, for children, which fits in an odd way.
Of course, of course. I just had my first experience yesterday with a rainy day walking my 5-year-old home, and his enjoying the mud.
That was your first experience?
With serious mud play, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Maybe it's called mud play.
Mud play?
I have no... Oh, man. I should look this up. It was originally, I think Kansas City Rep commissioned
right.
it, or Children's Theater Company.
Right. And New Victory, as for our listeners, is a New York-based children's theater presenter and developer.
He also has a piece coming up in the Under the Radar Festival at the Public in January, the 24-decade history of popular music, which is a durational theater piece that he's doing.
It's going to be 24 hours, right? 1 hour dedicated to each decade?
I believe that's true, and I believe 6 or 8 of them are being done at Under the Radar. I think he's going to do it in like short pieces throughout the festival, and there's going to be one culminating event where he does the whole piece together. That's my understanding.
Looking forward to the medieval chapter. No, just kidding. That'll be more than one chapter, I guess. Also in this issue, I'll just do a quick hits of some of the things we like the best. Really, really excited about our other big feature, which is about long form improv. TJ and Dave, improvised Shakespeare Company, Baby Wants Candy. It's a whole exploding genre, which, you know, has always been, it's been going on in all kinds of spaces over the years, but it's increasingly going into quote-unquote legit theaters, the Barrow Street Theater in New York and others. And it's increasingly, you know, drawing audiences outside college students and improv and comedy fans. So It's a great piece by Matthew Love. I'm really excited about that.
And we have an online exclusive for that from Sir Patrick Stewart.
Sir Patrick Stewart himself has become a company member of Improvised Shakespeare Company in New York. And I don't think he's in every show, so the expectation is that he's not always there.
Darn.
But we have a piece where he describes his discomfort with improvising and how he learned to stop worrying and love it.
Yeah, so we'll add him to our roster of, you know, astute writers.
Sure, he's one of our writers now. Also very excited that there's a piece about Reduced Shakespeare Company, which we've all seen their cottage industry explode over the past decade or more with the complete works of William Shakespeare and the complete Bible, complete sports. They've gone into every field.
History of comedy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That's the newest one, I think.
And I've never seen their story told. I didn't really know their story.
I've never seen their story told either, but I did when I was studying abroad in college. I went to Stratford-upon-Avon in England to do a Shakespeare study where we would see a different Shakespeare show every night and we would write about it. We went to everything at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford. We went to the Globe in London. And one night we went to see the Reduced Shakespeare Company's The Complete Works of William Shakespeare as one of our like legit English class like Shakespeare performances that we saw that night. And I just loved it. That was the first time I'd seen them. I think that was in 2003 or 2004 in London when they had a really successful run there. And I was able to go back about a year later, and I saw the Bible abridged, and the Complete History of America abridged. It's very funny. It's very fused in comedy. It's almost like improv. It feels kind of like long form improv, except that it's scripted. It kind of feels like SNL meets Shakespeare, and it's performed by three guys. They all play all the parts, and so it's a really cool story to kind of hear about their founding, and all their works that they've written have been licensed now. I think when I was in college, somebody did one of their productions. And
when I was in college too,
Deep and I went to college together.
Yes, though 2 years apart, of course.
I wrote about it for the UCLA Daily Bruin.
The the Shakespeare, the one I saw was Shakespeare.
Yep.
Oh,
but I wrote about it for the Daily Bruin.
Oh my God,
we
might have been the same audience, but we didn't meet.
You read her
now.
Article and it made you interested, and you went.
You read
and
my
saw
article
it?
And it made her interested, and then I hired her as a reporter on the UCLA Daily Bruin. True story.
Wow,
that's going to be the mythology from now on.
I'm also really excited in this issue, and maybe Rob can talk a little bit more about this, about our 20 questions subject.
Howl
Landon.
I love that.
Howl
Landon.
Oh, really?
Yes. Howl Landon Jr., who's been playing Scrooge for...
It'll be his 35th Scrooge this December.
At South Coast Rep in California.
South Coast Rep in Costa Mesa. Did you see him at that theater or no?
No, I have a thing against the Christmas Carol.
All right.
But he's been doing it for 35 years.
I saw him at some point along the way there, and he still does this thing where he, right when Scrooge, spoiler alert, becomes really a good man at the end.
Whoa! I didn't know that.
And finds the joy of Christmas. He's in it like a nightshirt, and he flips over the he like does a somersault over the bed into his top hat. It's a great bit of physical comedy, and he's 80 now, I think, and or close to that, and he still does it. So, no, it was great to talk to him. I think he may be the longest running Scrooge in the country, at least at a Equity Theater. So
yeah, I think I just randomly sent out an email. I was like, why don't we do a 20 questions with some guy who's played Scrooge a lot? And Rob was like, there's this guy at South Coast Rock.
He gets interviewed about it a lot. It's true, and he's happy to do
though.
It. Yeah, yeah. We also had a piece on Gabriel Kahane, who's a songwriter, a composer, whose new record's all about Los Angeles. It's a very Los Angeles focused issue, or at least we found ways to think about it.
For one,
isn't
good.
The Ambassador Gabriel Kahane's show coming to BAM though?
But it's coming to BAM.
So New York.
But it's about LA.
But it's about LA.
Yeah, and it's an album he's performing as a sort of theater piece directed by John Tiffany. So that's an interesting piece. I think, I mean, there's a lot of other great stuff in our issue. We should probably move on to our interview with Diane Rodriguez now, with Deep and I Did. And after that, we'll come back and give our recommendations. Stay tuned.
Welcome, Diane Rodriguez. Rob and I are sitting down with Diane, who is the director, writer, and performer, and also an associate producer at Center Theater Group in Los Angeles.
I'm actually associate artistic director now.
Well, I swear, your Wikipedia article is, your Wikipedia page is out of date. We should update that.
Where do you go to get your Wikipedia page updated?
I mean, I think you have to do it yourself, right? Or no?
Oh, do you?
Yes,
you can.
I think
oh, okay,
so.
You can do it
you
yourself.
You can say whatever.
Somebody else set that up, and I'm like, wow, that's really good, but I've not updated it.
I know. I think I looked at the Wikipedia source, and then I looked at the Latino Theater Commons source as well,
okay.
And I guess
well, this
I should have double-checked.
This is a very recent development, so don't feel too bad. This happened in the last almost 2 months.
Oh, okay.
If less time.
Could I ask who else is in the lofty position of associate artistic director? Is it just you?
There's three of us.
Okay.
It's a huge, major, big old West Coast organization.
Yeah.
So there, I have two mm-hmm. colleagues, Kelly Kirkpatrick and Neil Keller, who are also associate artistic
okay.
directors. So there's three of us.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also the president of the board of Theater Communications Group.
That's right. I'm starting my second year.
Oh my God, you're a busy woman.
Mm-hmm. And you just walked out of a big board meeting.
We did.
I don't know if you could say anything about where TCG is at.
You know, we are really putting theater folks, theater workers at the center of our work, which I think is really exciting and necessary. It used to be that, you know, we were focused on the theater organizations. But really, we're focused on the theater workers. And organizations obviously house those workers. But also, there are artists in the communities or theater makers that don't work at these big institutions or small institutions or mid-sized ones. And so we are also trying to focus on them. And a really big initiative that, you know, was a big focus, it was our diversity, inclusion, and equity initiatives. That was big focus at our conference this year. But also at the Fall Forum, which happened this weekend. I mean, everything happened this weekend. And the staff is amazing because there was a Fall Forum, and then we had this board meeting for 2 days, and then we had a gala, which is really only 3 years. You know, this is only our third one. So that's been a very different experience in terms of fundraising for this organization. But, you know, also about this notion of how to, you know, govern was big, a thing that happened at the Fall Forum, and new ways of listening to each other at the board level and at leadership level. And so that's very exciting because I think we all have to change our culture And people say, why? You know? And I think the question of how do you sustain your theaters when so many are closing? And this notion of diversity, inclusion, and equity, why? And you say, because so many theaters are closing. And there's got to be a new response. There's got to be a new step forward, right? What are we doing to keep those people engaged, our audiences engaged, what, you know, whoever they are, our loyal ones that have been going to the theater for years, as well as those that we want to keep and develop, that 25 to 45-year-old age everyone's after. So anyway, so that there's that. And then we did a really cool exercise at the board level. You know, we've never done meeting agreements. And people do them, a lot of organizations, when they're running meetings or these small convenings that you go to across the country that theater artists are doing, you do meeting agreements. You're like, what the hell is that, right? And meeting agreements are basically how you're going to interact with each other at a meeting. Be respectful. Listen actively, you know. Understand that many people come from there's different levels at the meeting, at a meeting, at a gathering, and that you listen to all, right? That everyone is at the table. So we did actually an exercise at the very beginning of our TCG board meeting. And we had people, like, we broke up into groups, and we're like, how would you like people to conduct themselves at our board meeting? And people did this big list, and then we came back, and then we had them all on the, you know, on these big pieces of paper, and then we had people vote on the top 10. And we're going to include these in our packets. It's a small thing. But it is a way of us, because our board members are very, very diverse. I mean, you know, you have some who are working artists, who are playwrights, then you have some who are artistic directors, and then you have some professionals who are outside of the field, who are attorneys, and you have all these different voices, and you want to hear everyone. So how are we going to do that? And how are we going to make sure that everyone's opinion is listened to, because those opinions are represent people that we're representing at this board level. So it's that idea of creating equity, access, you know, to different voices. So it was a really cool start of this new season with new board members at the table. That's good.
It's interesting. The equity part that's being emphasized is interesting, because it's gone beyond just having the people in the room, mm-hmm. but also giving them an equal stake or an mm-hmm. equal place at the table, right? Equity yeah. being some sense that they have, even if they're from a smaller theater, they have as much voice.
That's right. But also access to opportunity.
Right.
So that's the big thing, that it goes beyond being in the room. Mm-hmm. It's if there is an opportunity that they have a way of knowing about that opportunity like everyone else and growing with that opportunity. Thing is, right now, you know, there's this big, somebody wrote a blog about this, you know, hiring in one of our major West Coast theaters, in which the job was not posted, and it was kind of an associate, you know, knew the theater very well, and they hired him, and that's actually happened at our own theater at Center Theater Group. And if jobs aren't opened up publicly, then people don't have the opportunity to apply. And part of the thing is, a lot of these big jobs that are, you know, and right now I bring this up because we're at a point in the theater field where there's a big transition happening. A lot of some people are retiring, or others are leaving their position and moving on, and there's a lot of change, and that's great, because now there's opportunity, but we need access to that opportunity. We need to know that these jobs are happening, and you don't jump from 0 to 10, right? You can't run Center Theater Group and be executive director if you haven't taken the steps to get there. And But if you don't have opportunity to take steps, then you're never going to get there. And so that's what equity is about.
The access to those associate and intermediary steps to get to be groomed for those positions.
That's what exactly you're saying. Yeah. You need to be groomed.
Right, right. Right.
And that's why it's so important. You can be at the table, but it's steps to get to the table that are so important.
It's so interesting because, well, since American Theater is published by TCG, like Rob and I and the rest of the staff at TCG have also gone through diversity and inclusion meetings, and which, you know, we unpack terms and address unconscious biases and talk to what it means to us on a personal level. Mm-hmm. And so, well, what's so interesting about these kind of initiatives is it's not like looking at the it's not starting with a big question of how do we change institution or how do we change people's minds, but kind of seeing where all of these biases are coming from and looking at our own blind spots to look at it at a micro level first.
Yes, and it happens. It's individuals, you know. It starts with the individual and individual change, you know, and then that individual change impacts your company. Or your ensemble, or your friends, and so I think that's what we're seeing, and I think across the country, it's necessary to have these conversations. It's just necessary. We, or else, my goodness, how far behind we will be, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because when we're talking about these issues of diversity or gender parity, then the point always comes up where it's not in our radar, or we don't know of these names,
right.
Or
right.
Like we're not thinking about that when we're programming. We're just programming the best artists,
right.
But then it's not addressing the unconscious part of, well, why aren't we thinking about it?
Right. And one of the other things I think that came up at the board level was, you know, we just had an election, and the there's the change of power. Basically, in both the Senate and Congress, right? And we can't be defeated if we feel like, okay, our guy or gal was not voted in. We have to continue to advocate for the issues at hand that affect us in the theater community. And so, and there were some passionate moments at the board meeting today from some of our board members who advocacy needs to be front and center of the work we do at TCG, and our membership needs to be a part of that, and we need numbers. We don't need a few hundred. We need thousands of people to advocate for certain issues, right? And I thought that was quite important to note. And how we do that is...
Do you mean advocacy for arts funding, the usual kind of thing, that, or other issues?
I mean, arts funding, there's the initiative that's been always ever-present, taking away the when you would donate money.
Oh, yeah, the nonprofit tax deduction. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So, I mean, there are always, things in our communities that we need to be aware of. Right. So we went last year as a board to to D.C. It was the first time we'd ever had a board meeting outside of New York City. It was fantastic. And we went to Washington, and Lori Bascom, who's, our advocacy expert here at TCG, set us up, and we went to the Hill and the board. And it was just a great experience for those of us who had never done that. I would love to be able to do that every other year. Take us out of New York City, right? Get us into at least to D.C., I mean, ideally I'd love to go out to the country and have board meetings somewhere else outside of New York, but sometimes logistically that is impossible. So, but, one of the things about diversity and inclusion and equity, this weekend, there's so much happening in the world, the Latino Encuentro happened in Los Angeles. It started on Thursday and it went till Sunday. And I actually had a great salon that happened on Wednesday night when a lot of people were in town, and it was celebrating 80 years of ensemble theater, 30 years of Culture Clash, and 50 years of El Teatro Campesino.
Happy birthday to them.
Yeah, happy birthday to them. And so we had, you know, it was an evening I interviewed, you know, Culture Clash, and then we took an intermission and then brought on the Teatro founder and members. And it was grand. It was really a great way of sort of kicking off this whole thing that is bringing, this whole convening that's bringing national ensembles to Los Angeles. And then everyone was able to see people's shows. So you saw three shows in one day, and then early in the morning you would talk about those shows, about their aesthetics, about what the companies were trying to achieve, how they were achieving them, what the aesthetic was in order to achieve. So it really also was talking about the art-making process and the results of that, which I think was quite interesting. Then they also had these fellows that were there from... because the Encuentro has been going on, was on nearly a month before sort of the national professionals came for that last 4 days.
It was a festival of plays, and then you had like the conference-style
right,
meetings.
Right, that's right. And they have chosen fellows to participate in the whole month-long activity. They got paid for being there. They were housed. And it was a diverse group of, I mean, there were mostly Latinos, but there was an Asian, Ricky Pack, who runs a theater in East LA, whose members, some are Latino. And he felt, and there was an affinity he had to the community, and he was chosen as one of the fellows. And we had an African-American gal, also the same from the Bay Area, had an affinity. So I loved the diversity of that group and the welcoming feeling of all to come and participate, which is really a great value for that whole festival. And you know, Los Angeles Theater Center, what a great space.
Still a great space. I love that space.
Still a great space. Four theaters, including now a gallery downstairs that they use as a performance space for the solo shows. Fabulous. And so five performing spaces. I mean, wow.
And is the Latino Theater Company, they're basically running it. They're the resident company
they
there?
They are. Yeah. And we are talking about, you know, I think a growing success story there. I mean, I think how hard. What a struggle. But Jose Luis Valenzuela, who's the artistic director of the Latino Theater Company and who runs the Los Angeles Theater Center, there are two entities, has, you know, he has had a big struggle, but he has managed to keep the doors open. I think it's now 7 years.
Yeah, I don't know when you date that from, but yeah, 7 years.
I think it's around that long. He's got an amazing board of supporters, and they've managed to keep the doors open, and were granted by the Mellon Foundation, NGW Mellon Foundation, to fund these fellows for the Encuentro, which I think is a very big move and a big show of support for his work. So, great.
They don't just program works from the Latino theater community. It's small ensembles.
That's right.
Solo shows.
That's right. So basically what he does is, like so many of us who are trying to do diverse programming, he says it's what you see on the communities on the street, you see in my theater. And so it's, you know, all, you know, the Roby Theater, it's, you know, Playwrights Arena. It's just all these different companies that use the space there, not just Latino.
It's maybe a big question, but you're, you know, a veteran of these debates and this scene. What is it about this moment that's different, or that maybe, do you feel like the conversation has advanced from the 90s and the August Wilson Ground on Which I Stand debate about theaters of color? Do you think it's advanced from then, or is it the same kind of issues that are mainstream versus theaters of color?
I mean, I think it has advanced. I don't think for most it's advanced as quickly as one would want. But I mean, the fact that, you know, because this, the notion of Latino theater companies gathering is not a new one. This is the biggest gathering in the last 24 years. But prior to that, in the early 70s, for at least 12 or 13 years, there would be these gatherings nearly yearly across the Southwest of Latino companies coming together, mostly Chicano companies together, and doing the very same thing, performing for each other, right, critiquing each other's work. Believe me, the critiques were brutal in those days. Nobody wanted to be a part of it. We did a big festival in Mexico in 1974. We took a train down there. Everybody from Latin America, including the United States, go. And, you know, a lot of Chicanos don't speak Spanish. So to be critiqued by all these intellectuals, and we're talking about identity, and they're talking about disappearances and torture, and they're like, what? Mamby Pamby? You're talking about identity, you know, when we're dealing with these life and death issues.
Right.
So the difference was profound, right?
Right.
And so flash forward to today, where our issues have gone beyond identity.
Right.
The world is, you know, we're commenting on the issues of the world.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's the difference. And then we're running theaters that have five spaces. And we're coming and able to afford, one company able to afford the producing of, you know, able to afford, I mean, vis-a-vis fundraising, producing an entire festival, right? So, and that person being not only a leader in the field, Latino theater field, but a leader in the national field.
Right, right.
So in those ways, you see, and then we have, you know, companies and field art, field-wide artists who are leaders, again, in the Latino thing field, and then nationwide. So we didn't have that before.
Right, that they weren't at that level.
Weren't at that level, and right. So we were most of it was a lot more siloed. I mean, I can think of three. I wasn't able to be at all of the Encuentro. Chris Acebo, who is the Associate Artistic Director of Ashland, was not able to be at the Encuentro. Luis Alfaro, you know, a playwright, was not able to be. He had a show running. You know, like, there were all these artists who were out there working who couldn't and wanted to be at the Encuentro, and all of us had been in Boston in the first, meeting last year. Of this.
Because you're all working group.
Because we're all working in the field.
In the field, in the national field.
In the national field. So, you know what I'm saying?
Which is the measure of success, right?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. That's okay. Right.
Right.
So, it has changed.
It's important also, though, to keep the roots strong that from which those artists have come.
We need
right?
that. We need those roots. And we need that level. We need that level to it's the almost the food chain. It's the ecology. It's like you start here. You start in your communities. You learn all of your values of activism in these small companies. You learn, you know, and you practice that. And that becomes your foundation. Because, you know, Latino theater, at least Chicano theater, is rooted in activism. It's rooted in social change and then social justice. And when you are trained that way and raised that way in the theater, those values never leave you. I work at a major regional theater. Those values that I learned at the Teatro Campesino, I take them with me. I take them here at the boardroom at TCG. They are with me always. So I think that that's very special. A very special value that we get and we share with other Latino groups who are not necessarily from the Southwest.
Yeah. And just a little bit of background, the Encuentro was put on by LATC and also by the Latino Theater Commons, which
That's
was founded
right.
in 2012, and they're hosted by HowlRound.
That's right.
Who,
has been an amazing supporter and advocate, who also has been sharing quite a few values that a lot of us in the field have taken on. So you know, we want to give them credit. I think the important thing for I always think art, you know, in terms of becoming theater lovers, the theater has to be in your community in order to easily go, and that it has to be accessible. So either you go to the community to do your theater, you go, they don't come to you, you go to them. Or they come to you because you're a storefront and you're easy to get to. Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights. Perfect example. You just step in. There's no step even. It's street level. And it's easily accessible. And those companies are important to us because they create theater-going audiences. They're at the first level, at the ground level. And then those audiences, they keep going. I went to a show at Casa 0101. It was like a date night. Couples when they were young, 20s, and they were watching a show. Mm-hmm. And they keep going to Casa 0101 for 10 years, they might get interested in what else is going on in the theater. And that's why these companies are necessary and important to us, particularly if they only do Latino theme work that relates to the community at hand in their area.
Yeah, it's not like a grand thing on a hill.
But then there are companies like the Latino Theater Company, or Pregones, for example, here in New York, in the Bronx, who are doing work that the writing is so. They just did, Pregones did Margarita Gomez, writings by Margarita Gomez. Her writing, when you listen to it, it washes over you. It just is so comforting, her use of language and words and humor, that you're like, this is beyond Latino. This is good writing. This is, you know, and so that's what makes it universal, and that's why other audiences are able to participate in it and listen to it. And the Latino Theater Company, on the other hand, has a very strong physical aesthetic. All of their shows are beautifully composed, masterfully acted, skillfully directed. So that you may not, the story, okay, maybe I don't get the story as much, but the experience was excellent. So it becomes competitive on, you know, multiple levels. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think we have everything in between. Latino theater, everything in between. So we're at a good,
full range.
Full range. And it's not even fully realized yet. You know, we're on our way.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to monopolize too much the conversation, but I shift gears too much. But you mentioned Casa 101, which I wanted to ask you about, which is, I love that theater. Segueing to LA Theater, which I know really well. And,
don't you two go way back?
We go way back. We were neighbors.
In Echo Park, yeah.
In Echo Park. Yeah. I still live there. He deserted us.
I know.
I just have to say. He betrayed us and moved to New York. Hello.
I miss it every day, I tell you. So I wanted to ask you about this. Have you been following the debate about the 99-seat plan? Are you a signatory of the Reimagine LA Theater? Or?
And what's the 99-seat?
Well, the 99-seat plan is the showcase code in LA by which equity members can work in theaters under 99 seats for almost no money, and for long periods of time. It's a more generous to producers code than here in New York or San Francisco. And some folks there, I think, you know, they have a case that they're making that equity should not allow equity actors to work under such terms, and they should ask for more. And it's a scene, exists because actors wanted to get on stage, but I think maybe it's changed now so that actors, they want to get on stage, but they'd like to be compensated better. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think, first of all, I have to admit, it's a very intimidating subject because both sides are strong-voiced and adamant that their side is right.
Right.
And at the core of it is a labor issue.
Yes.
And pay.
Yes.
For actors.
Yeah, which is a field-wide debate right now.
Exactly, which is field-wide. And beyond theater, this is a national issue of being paid a living wage. And even the minimum wage is not living, but at least the minimum wage for your work. And actors are not getting that. So everyone acknowledges that it's a broken system. Mm-hmm. But a huge economy has grown around this broken system. Mm-hmm. And to dismantle it is daunting. And people just don't know where to begin.
Right.
Both sides, one side, which they created a document, which was this call to action.
Yeah, the reimagined.
The reimagined.
reimagined LA Theater document.
LA Theater.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I've read various copies of it, and I feel like the voices of change need to come from those that really are participating in. I can't, as a regional theater person, say, you need to change, you know, because I'm not a full-time worker in this.
In the trenches of 99 Seat,
trenches of 99 Seat, although I have directed numerous 99 Seat shows.
Right.
I've always gotten a fee. And the actors get minimum for
sure.
Parking. And it just, you know, it bothers me. What can you say?
Yeah.
It needs to change. Equity says that they're going to come out with a plan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When?
Well,
haven't we heard this before?
Yes, of course.
And there's a producer's component in this controversy.
Yes.
That have been very longstanding and very involved from the beginning.
Yes.
In this, who are saying they want change too.
Yeah.
I ask when.
Right.
What is your idea? Let's hear it.
Yeah.
Why is it taking so long?
Yeah.
Right. And I just, it, we all need, know it needs to change, but how and who is going to change it? And how are we going to bridge the gaps between these two very headstrong groups of people?
Yes, yes. No, I've got friends
and
colleagues on both sides of it, and I'm trying to sort it out myself, you know.
I mean, I have sat down literally with both sides.
Yeah.
Tell me what is going on.
Yeah.
Let me listen. And I come out more confused. And I'm, you know, I was asked to write something about it, and I eventually said I can't.
Yeah.
It is such a complicated issue.
Yeah.
And to what you know, aside from this notion of workers getting paid,
right?
You know, but in the end, I want actors to be at the center of it. It's about them,
right?
So why can't we have actors be the activists in this? All I hear is producers,
right? Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, it's going to come down to the Actors Union. If the Actors Union comes up with a plan their members reject, which is, if the actors want to get on stage for less, then that's what it's going to come down to. If they want to get on stage for less,
that's right. And if they want to get paid, then we need to hear from them.
Right, right.
So I think that this whole thing is, it needs to lie in the activism of those actors.
Yeah.
And where are they in this? And all I talk to are producers.
Yeah. Well, they're the ones who are worried about their whole system getting their budgets going up and their theaters closing. I mean, that's what they worry will happen if Equity. I think there's been more non-union theater if Equity comes out with a plan like that, you know.
And it's hard to talk about if you say there's more non-union.
There will be more. Yeah. I mean, there's fewer Equity members will be able to work in shows of that size, which I guess won't be the end of the world. But
no,
they're trying to increase work weeks for Equity actors.
Yeah.
But it's a story we're going to be watching, and I know the relationship between Center Theater Group and the rest of the LA theater scene. Do you feel like that's a strong one?
I think that we're really trying to grow it. I think like. So much is happening in the field.
Yeah.
These meeting agreements, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That we have to listen. We were branded a few years ago. My theater might hate me for saying this, but we were branded a few years ago as being LA's theater company.
Whoa.
Wow.
Whoa.
And all of it. You know, this was we had a branding.
It's a big responsibility, right?
It is a big responsibility, and we weren't doing it very well, quite frankly, and I think a lot of our staff thinks that,
right?
You know,
right.
And we struggled with it. We tried, you know, and it just, you know, the staff struggled with it, and so we'd always try to support local companies and help. So what we did this year, let me just talk about what we did this year.
Yeah.
It's like we had a commission. And with a group called Burglars of Ham.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and we worked on the piece, and then they wanted to produce it, so we gave them some money to produce it with Sacred Fools.
Right, and they did it at their space
in
Hollywood.
Did it at their space in Hollywood.
Right.
And it looked fantastic and got great reviews. And we were able to help a company sort of up the ante and really do a great job. In
the Behavior of Brodus was the show,
Behavior
right?
of Brodus, right.
Or Brodus, sorry, Brodus.
Brodus was the show. And we want to do that on a yearly basis. So that's one way of our supporting. The other is when we did Radar LA. We've done two Radar LAs. Our last one was last year. There were a number of local companies that were in the festival that we supported, that we paid a fee to, that we commissioned in some instances. Theater Movement Bizarre. We did a piece in the festival. So that was another way of us supporting local theater as much as, you know.
And is Radar LA going to continue? Going to do another one of those?
Radar LA is, we are trying to figure out how we can fundraise.
Right.
In the way that we really can sustain the festival.
Right, okay.
And so both Mark Murphy being at Red Cat,
yeah.
who is our major partner, and who we've continued to work with on this off year of Radar, we did the Gob Squad together, and Olga Garay, who used to be the director of cultural affairs for the City of LA, the three of us are trying to figure out how we can make it a sustainable festival, and we need a lot of help.
Right. Well, great, Diane. There was a lot to talk about.
A lot to talk about, right?
What are you working on right now?
I'm working on a couple of things, but mostly I have a couple of things. I'm working, everyone says, oh, you're so brave, but I'm working with Richard Montoya and Roger Guinevere Smith on a piece that they will create together about the community of Venice after World War II. And it was a very big black community in Venice, California, and also a big Latino community. So we're telling the story of of this community and how these two groups lived together or didn't, you know.
Yeah.
And we're at the very, very beginning. It's a commission at Center Theater Group, and I'll direct it. We start off many of our commissions and our with days where we bring in experts in the field. And Josh Kuhn at USC wrote a book on black-brown relations in Los Angeles. And it came out after we had decided we were going to do this, so it's perfect. So we're bringing in Josh and his collaborator on one of the days, and you know, so it'll be a really cool way of us starting to dig in. So that's, and I'm at the very beginning of that. And then the second project I'm working on is I'm going to go to a director's retreat in December, and I'm going to work on my new play. I have a new play called The Sweetheart Deal. And it's about, it takes place in 1970 in Salinas, California, during a big lettuce boycott. And it's a story of a young Latino couple, middle class, who live in San Jose and decide to sell everything and volunteer for the underground newspaper called El Malcriado. And a number of unforeseen circumstances happen, and their life is turned upside down. And it's loosely based on a story of my aunt and uncle who.
So it's your play. You wrote it.
It's my play, and I wrote it. Yeah.
Wow.
And so I've written plays that I have directed myself. I don't think I want to direct all my plays, but this one I definitely want to direct. So.
Of course, it's personal.
Yeah, it's personal.
And where is it? Does it have a production?
It doesn't have a production at this moment. It's still very much in development. But I was at New Harmony Playwrights Project in New Harmony, Indiana, in May, and then it was at the Atlantic Latino Mix Fest here in New York City in June. And so it continues to be developed. Yeah,
got a lot going
cool.
on.
Cool. Well, thank you guys.
Great. It's great to talk to you, Diane.
Thank you.
Yeah, catch up.
We'll see you next board meeting, I guess.
All right, yes, which is soon. Okay, thanks.
And we're back. We're here to offer our recommendations of things to see, read, think about. What do you got, Susie?
Well, I was trying to look back on my show-going history that I've seen, and I just remembered, and I know this might sound it's a kind of a weird thing to recommend, but I got to see Emma Stone's third performance as Sally Bowles in Cabaret, and I have to say, she's pretty amazing, like, kind of incredible. Her scene work and her presence on stage and her charisma in the part, she's a pretty perfect Sally Bowles, and I was kind of bowled over by her performance. I did not expect that much. I mean, I like Emma Stone. I think Emma's really likable, and I think she's right for the part. I've seen her most of her films, but usually when a film actress, maybe I'm thinking of her predecessor in the role, comes to the theater, you can kind of see that they're not used to the form, or that their singing voice isn't really strong, or they're not in the scene the whole time because they're used to the camera panning off of them. But she's really, really good, and it was only her third performance, so she still had plenty of things to work out, I'm sure. And her singing was good. I mean, it wasn't amazing, but Sally as a character is not supposed to be an amazing singer, so I think it was okay that it was good. Her rendition of the final Cabaret, that song was spellbinding. She's really good. So if you can get tickets to see Emma Stone in Cabaret, I'd say it's worth every single penny you have.
Is Danny Burstein still in it?
Danny Burstein is still in it. Alan Cumming is still in
okay.
it.
Okay. I should try to check that out.
I have such a crush on Emma Stone. She's the redheaded version. Not
she's
so
a redhead in Cabaret.
Yes.
Got a cute little short redhead bob. It's probably a wig, but it looks like Emma Stone red hair.
Nice.
It's worth seeing.
Good recommendation. That show will run forever.
It'll run forever. I think Emma's in it until February.
And she was the original choice to do that, to do the role in the revival,
yeah.
And then she had to step out. So
there was a little bit of drama in that she had to step out because she had too busy of a film promoting schedule, I believe, and so she had to step out. And now she's coming back in, and she's really good.
Sounds good. Deep?
Mine's not show-related, since I don't want to make it, you know, too New York-based. But so I recently discovered this comic on The Toast. It's called Dirtbag Shakespeare. And they basically do, like, an abridgment of Shakespeare plays using a cast of teenage dirtbags.
What is a dirtbag, Deep?
A dirtbag is kind of it's teenage, so it's kind of like teenage... Jerky teenagers.
Jerky teenagers, right.
Which,
right,
you know, okay. If you look at it from a certain angle, aren't all Shakespeare characters kind of jerky teenagers, with the exception of Romeo and Juliet, who are jerky.
Hamlet? Come on. Totally a jerky teenager.
Who's the cartoonist?
They only recently had a cartoonist.
Oh, I see. Oh,
yeah.
And now it's
a cartoon slash, you know, short play, but before it was just a short play.
Oh, it was just the text. Okay, I didn't realize. Yeah, yeah.
But the newest one, huh?
Yeah, go on, the newest one.
The newest one is The Tempest, and I figured since it's kind of a short play, we can act it out.
We can read it?
Yes.
Are we going to act it out for everyone? I think you and Rob need to do this. I think there's Ferdinand and Ariel.
So we can either do Ferdinand and Ariel, or we can do Prospero and Miranda, which is also pretty funny.
I think let's do Prospero and Miranda, since, you know, we have the right genders, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, good.
So
you
I'll
can be my
Miranda.
Father. Okay.
So this is a scene somewhere in the play. We set it up for Steve.
Well, in The Tempest, as everyone knows, Prospero's on an island,
sure.
and he sees his brother, the Duke of Milan, who, you know, usurped him on a boat with his family, and so he
talk about a dirtbag, man.
Yes, and then he creates a tempest to, you know, drown them and drown them slash, you know, trap them on this island,
right.
And now he's introducing the Duke of Milan's son to his daughter Miranda because he wants her to marry him, I guess?
Any other direction I need here? Or should I read it as flatly as possible here? Here, I'll just jump in. This is Prospero.
Jerky as possible, Rob.
Do you see him? You're going to marry him.
Who?
Him, the very wet man.
All right. He's actually quite good looking. I wouldn't mind.
Shut up. I said you're going to marry him. I didn't ask for your life story.
I'm sorry. I just meant I wouldn't mind getting married.
Where's your off button?
My what?
Shut down.
I don't have that. I'm a human woman. You can't just turn me off.
Shh. You sleep now. Wow, that's great. I hope I could put enough into that for our readers.
I think we summed up their relationship right there. Prospero, horrible father.
I now understand The Tempest.
I think I needed to do one of those things where actors run around the building first and then come in here really mad. But that would have been made a better reading. But I'll do that next time.
Or go punch a wall or something.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Well, I look forward to reading more of that. Mine is a show recommendation. I recently saw Our Lady of Cabejo, which the African characters in the play call Chibejo, but everyone, all the white characters and the playwright call Cabejo. Anyway, Cabejo is a township in Rwanda, in which a true story in the early 80s, there were visions. Girls at a young college had visions of Mary speaking to them, Our Lady of Sorrows, and one of the visions they had was of killing fields, which was later interpreted as a prophecy of the genocide in Rwanda. And it's one of the only, I think it is the only authenticated or confirmed recognized Marian sighting in Africa. There's a few in Latin America, as we know, and of course Lourdes in Europe. And, you know, it's a pretty amazing spectacular play. Pretty much takes at face value the visions and has some amazing coups de theater, if I said that right, coup de théâtre, in which, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers, but I think there was wind blowing through that theater. There were trees rustling and people levitating and what I like most about the play, though, is that it sets up a very very familiar storyline, what I call the inquest drama, in which, you know, religious authority tries to quash private revelations. A very common story. And a lot of the scenes, the arguments between the priests and the nuns, you know, the priest who wants to believe and the old mean old nun who doesn't believe and the bishop who just wants people to come to the parish to see the miracle. It's very, very familiar battle lines are drawn. But then it gets, in the second act, it gets weirder and more interesting and really kind of moving about the question of, you know, what kind of God would give you visions like that and then leave you powerless to stop the genocide. So I was a big early fan of Katori Hall. I saw a play called Hoodoo Love of hers at Cherry Lane many years ago. Thought it was really promising. I was not a big fan of The Mountaintop, at least the way it appeared on Broadway. That's been a great play for her. It's been all over the country, and I wish her all the best with it. It felt overblown, and maybe if I'd seen it in a small downtown theater, I would have thought it was great. But this play, which is at the Signature Theater and is directed by Michael Greif, is really feels like a writer we should really pay attention to. I really, really enjoyed it, Our Lady of Cabejo. You don't have to be Catholic to enjoy it. It's, in fact, it might help if you're not. No, it's quite enjoyable, and I recommend it. Look for it. Hopefully it'll be produced as much as The Mountaintop. So that's another edition of AT Off Script. Go online to americantheater.org to read more.
Thanks for joining us.